I wanted to share a glimpse of the kind of content that makes up Northern Spirit Radio programs. With a mass of 9+ years of programs for both Song of the Soul and Spirit in Action, I could have spent an entire month trying to find just the right clips to share with you, but instead, I decided to limit myself to an arbitrary couple-week period, in this case, the end of September 2014. So here is a collection of several short segments from those weeks that give a flavor of the programs as they touch on the vision statement for Northern Spirit Radio. Here they are. First up is from the Song of the Soul program for September 28th, and the guest is Sam Sellers, who performs hip-hop, rap music, under the name Rabbi Darkside. And you'll just have to listen to the program to know where that moniker comes from. Sam was raised Jewish, but is decidedly not a rabbi. So I wanted to invite out his spiritual identity. You know, one thing I noticed in Morning Paper, your tagline there, notebooks and sketchbooks and wine bottles and hymns. Now, hymns, I don't particularly connect with Jewish culture.
Sure. For me, poetry and prayers have grown to be synonymous. Being someone who doesn't really turn to a particular scripture on regular occasion, I find that I write my own meditations and write my own prayers and find that solace and that comfort in the words of other writers and singers. So I guess that's what I mean by using the word hymns. Very often within the live performance world that I'm fortunate enough to be in, you know, there'll be moments where it feels like church, you know, where the jam session is the spiritual experience of the day or of the week for me and for a lot of people who attend it. So, you know, I think it's about just claiming language and applying personal meaning to it.
Would it be fair to say that in some ways when you're performing, when you're rapping, when the words are flowing that way, that it's a form of meditation? Does that sound right?
100%. I agree with that. And I've been practicing a form of Tibetan meditation, actually, and really speaking of meditation, called the Kumye. It is rooted in the physical. It generally consists of holding a certain posture for an extended period of time, 10, 12 minutes, and training your mind to go inside the body. And I don't want to say think your way through pain, but it helps you focus on not necessarily the thing that you would initially be drawn to focus on. The instructor is constantly teaching about unifying and harmonizing with our surroundings, getting more attuned to the world, removing the ing from states of existence. So when, let's say, we're like going for a run, right? You're not focused on the fact that you're running. You're just on a run. So you're really living in the moment. And an analogy that he drew was between the feeling that a musician, while they're improvising, gets when they're totally locked in and totally open, and it's just like the stream of consciousness flowing freely, where you're not self-analyzing what's happening in real time, where you're just existing and letting it flow. So yes, very, very much so, that especially improvisation is a form of meditation for me.
Next up is my Spirit in Action interview with Don Ravella, who has worked with three different churches in some variation each time of director of social activism or ministry and outreach. And I wanted to explore why a person with a social work degree would prefer to work in the religious context. I note that your education started out with a Bachelor of Arts in Social Science and Psychology, and that was way back in 1989. And it wasn't till 2013 that you also got a doctorate of ministry, and that one from New York Theological Seminary. I'm intrigued by your concrete healing the world social worker side, and also the fact that you're doing this in religious contexts. And I've got a couple of questions about that. But first of all, back in 1989, when you got your BA degree, were you clearly headed to work within religious frameworks?
No, I started college as a business major. My dad was an entrepreneur, and I worked in his card store throughout high school and college. But while I was there, I started doing volunteer work. on my lunch hour, I'd go work in a soup kitchen, and at night I worked on a suicide hotline, and in the weekend I was a rape survivor advocate, and I thought that I would just be doing volunteer work. But one of the places that I was volunteering was a church. I heard a priest speak there. His name was Father John White, and he talked about the church as a sleeping giant. If you mobilize them, that the church could be a moral voice in the public arena for the issues, because when it doesn't take long when you're working with people in need to see that there's a lot of underlying issues that need to be addressed. It became clear to me that someone who's working really hard full-time but is making minimum wage and has children isn't going to make it, and there are other things that need to get addressed. And he talked about mobilizing the church to do those things, and I knew that that was exactly what I believed. And I went and spoke to him and spoke to people at Catholic Charities, and when there was a position open, they called me for it.
I had some more questions for Dawn Rivella, but I still wanted to get to a better sense from her of the pros and cons of doing activism in a faith community, knowing that many listeners might be anti-religious. So here's how I approached it. Part of my own perspective is, even though I'm Quaker and definitely part of a religious group, getting a group of Quakers to move together is a bit like herding cats. I think there's a number of other religious groups, including the Catholic Church I grew up in, where, you know, you get the encyclical or you get the pastoral letters, or you get those, and people step together more easily to them. Now, I don't know if that's your perspective or not, but it's like, okay, we're going to work together on this. In my Quaker group, people might say, well, maybe yes, maybe no. We're going to talk about that for a year before we decide that.
Right. And that I think that happens here as well. But my belief is that you only need a handful. It only takes a couple of people or a handful to make great things happen and to start movements. The church where I'm at now, there's a group of people that are on the Mission Council that were the ones that started spearheading to get my position in place years back. And they have a strong commitment to live out your faith through mission and social justice work and addressing human suffering and poverty. And that group has been, it's through that small group that so many great things have happened. And just the ministry here is exploding, which is very beautiful. We're helping other congregations that want to replicate some of our work. And the impact is huge. And I really believe that comes from the handful of people that care about these things. And the other people are proud and they're supporting them. And they're adding a lot to the efforts that are mostly by a handful of people. For example, when we have a weekly meeting for people returning from long-term prison sentences, there's other people in the church that aren't deeply engaged as the handful I'm speaking of, but they'll show up with a meal. It might be once a year, and they'll show up with a meal and dine with the people that are participating in the program. Or maybe they'll buy Christmas gifts for their children or something. But because we're a larger community, you can reach out and get lots of support. But then there's a lot of much more deep work that's being handled by this small committed group.
Just last week, I shared my interview with Greg O'Brien about his book about living with Alzheimer's. Greg's a writer and an Irishman, so he knows the importance of a good story, as opposed to simply trundling out the facts and speechifying. So it was fun to pull out a couple of his stories as part of the sharing. You mentioned earlier in the interview, too, the profane word for it is hallucinations, and you don't perceive what's there in the normal way. There are two stories that you told in the book that were particularly gripping for me. One is you're going to join some friends in a bar restaurant area, and you see them in a glass through a window, but you can't get over to them. And then the other one was you're flying on a plane with your daughter. Could you mention those stories? Because I think they really increased my understanding of what Alzheimer's is like from the inside.
Yes, I was with some clients on Martha's Vineyard. In addition to my writing, I'm a political and communication consultant. And, you know, God bless my friends and clients. They know, and I would say this as encouragement to others who are concerned about speaking out. I've had family, colleagues, and friends come and support me. And I've said, look, when I can't do it anymore, you'll know. But there are things I can't do now on the left side, but can't we celebrate what I can do right? And they've stood behind me. So there was this place where we went to in Martha's Vineyard for dinner after this meeting, and you know, these, I tell people, I'm not stupid, I just have a disease, and the brain gets sapped down, and it's, I say, my brain is like an iPhone, it's got a short-term battery. You know, an interview like this, God bless Molly for being with me, because there's no freaking way I could do this for an hour, and thank you for understanding that. And so I say my brain is like an iPhone, it's still a sophisticated device, but it pocket dials, it breaks down, it has a short battery, and it gets lost all the time. So I went into this restaurant on Martha's Vineyard, and I'm looking through, you know, there were two rooms there. There was the bar area, and then there was an area where people were seated down, and there was some glass separating it. And so I looked in, and I saw my colleagues, and I was waving at them, and so they waved back. And then I waved again, and they waved back, and then, you know, I kind of shrugged like, I can't figure out how to get in there. Then they start laughing, so I figured there was a way to get in there. And then in my mind told me that if I go in the men's room, there's going to be a door from there into this other room. I don't know why my mind would tell me that, but it did. And then I came back out, and I looked at him again, and I started talking through the window. And then I tried this other exit. What had happened was I was in plain as day, and I would have known this obviously years ago. This is after a meeting. No one's drinking here, so just for the record. But I was staring at a mirror, and they were behind me. And what was so cool about it, they knew that my brain was shutting down. They've always had a sense of humor, and they knew that I would think it's a funny story. And then they came up and they hugged me. But it was real. In my brain, my perception told me that there were two rooms there, and I was convinced of that.
And I asked Greg for this story specifically as well, something I knew of because I had actually read the whole book, and I thought it would appeal to all listeners, religious or not, kind of self-deprecating humor, but providing an entry to faith and the disease. And I want you to share one more. I don't know if this is a promise of Alzheimer's to come or whatever, but your first experience serving Mass as an altar boy. And by the way, since I was raised Catholic, and when I was in fifth grade, I started altar boy classes myself, but then we moved, and so I never finished. So I never actually got to serve Mass as you did. Your first experience, though, is wonderfully, horrifyingly delightful. You want to tell about that, Greg?
Yeah, I when you become an altar boy, and, you know, I went to a Catholic grammar school and 4 years of all boys Catholic high school at Archbishop Stepanek High School in White Plains, New York. And then I went to 2 years of Fairfield University, a Jesuit school. Then I transferred to the University of Arizona, and I saw women really for the first time. And I was like Hermie in the summer of 42. So that took me a while to understand, calm myself down. So they have, when you're not a full-fledged altar boy, you kind of serve on the side, and the main altar boys serve. And one of them didn't show up, and this guy said, well, Greg, you can do it. I didn't, you know, it's like my filter, and I kept saying, well, I was the little engine that could, you know, I could do it. So there's a Catholics would know this, or people go to church might, you know, the altar boys move around, and they do things, and they genuflect, and I was just following him. And he needed to be on the right side, because that's the side where you ring the bells when they hold the host up after the consecration. And in any Protestant denominations, and they know how that goes, and sometimes they don't ring bells, but in the Catholic Church they ring bells. There was a Monsignor who was named O'Brien, who was this real tough ex-Marine. So this guy Jackie and I were doing stuff, and you come to the middle of the altar, and you genuflect, and you move, and I'm on the left. Something went horribly wrong, and we genuflected, and I ended up on the right next to the bells. And the look on Jackie's face was like I had just burned down a convent full of nuns. He was scared. And he's like, and my mom is, you know, my hero. You know, she's a woman with all, she didn't have it then, well, she probably did, but she's in the third row, and she's all nervous because Jackie's hand signaling and made about what to do. So the priest, in the most dramatic part of the Mass, after the consecration of the host, the priest holds the host up, and that's, you're supposed to ring the bells three times. And he holds it up, Monsignor O'Brien, and nothing happens. And I panic. I have my hand on the bell, and I can't ring it. And Jackie is monitoring, and my mother is almost crying. Everyone in the church is realizing I'm not supposed to be in this position, and they're watching. And he says, ring the bell. And my hand froze. And he said, ring the bell. Now people in the first six rows are starting to laugh. And then the third time he goes, ring the bell. Now you could hear it throughout the whole church. The whole church is laughing. My mother is crying. And finally he yelled out, ring the damn bell. And I started ringing this thing for like 20 minutes. And there wasn't a dry eye in the church. And so, you know, maybe Alzheimer's goes back a long time.
And for this last segment from Greg O'Brien, I invited him to talk about how much we're identified with the brain and with our thoughts, which I figured was a pretty good entry point for talking about the part of us beyond those surface-level me identities.
You know, all of us like to see ourselves as the resume or the title on the business card or the stock portfolio. You know, as a writer, I've made a good living, but, you know, my focus has always been the mind in writing, and that's always been my identity. And when you lose that, or you lose your health, or you lose your stock portfolio, or you lose a child or a spouse, it brings you right down to who are you. This is not just a book about Alzheimer's. This is a window into the baby boom generation. It's not a book about me and my family. I'm the window into that. Sure, my friends care about me, but anyone listening needs to care more about them. This is a book about you and your family and your grandkids and anyone who's listening. And Alzheimer's is a perfect example of when you get stripped naked. And I've had to look at myself in the mirror, and there were things that I didn't like. And, you know, I said before, I have a strong faith, but I'm one of the world's greatest sinners, as imperfect as anyone else. The blessing for me of Alzheimer's in my relationship with the Lord is now I have an opportunity to see myself naked, to see into my heart and my soul, and an opportunity to try to change some things. And that's a blessing, and it's really at the core of who we are. I don't want to proselytize here, but I believe in heaven. And when we go there naked, you know? You don't get a bigger mansion in heaven because you had a big mansion on Cape Cod. It's about what your heart is about. In Alzheimer's, I've learned I don't trust my brain anymore. It used to be my best friend, and now I see little chance of reconciliation. But I trust my heart, and I've talked to Molly about this, and I'm kind of curious what she thinks. I've learned to speak through my heart and soul, and it's an unfiltered process, and obviously sometimes you say things that maybe are too honest or too candid, but speaking from the heart and writing from the heart is a lot easier process, and you come in connection, and I know that, again, I said before, they're different people with different spiritual values, and I respect that, but it allows you to connect with God or connect with the universe or whatever you want to define an all-powerful spiritual being. But there's something a heck of a lot bigger out there than we are.
One last very short clip from my Spirit in Action interview with Greg and Terry of the musical group Magpie. They were talking about and sharing music about current environmental issues, and I could sense that they deeply appreciated having a stage to reach out widely with their messages of concern. Here's how our visit ended, and no, I did not feed the script to Terry. Thank you both, Greg and Terry, for joining me today for Spirit in Action. Thank you for keeping up the good work in story and song.
Well, that comes right back at you, because we need people like yourself to broadcast that there are communities and people out in this world with spirit and passion to save and protect the earth.
Water's life, water from the rock.